This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and to entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we talk with an air race champion who's an author, a speaker, a former aerodynamics professor, an Embry-Riddle graduate, and the CEO of an aircraft management company. In the news, flight cancellations strand thousands of air travelers. Boeing 737 MAX flights are set to resume in Ethiopia and Indonesia, more 5G drama, and adaptive cycle engines for military applications. All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 685 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and joining me is Max Trescott. He's host of Aviation News Talk Podcast. He's a national CFI of the year, and he's an expert on the Cirrus aircraft.
Hey, happy new year, everybody. Welcome to 2020. I figured we might as well just do a do-over. You know, let's just go back, reset 2 years, see how it goes.
Try again.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, Rob Mark is also with us. He's contributing editor to Business and Commercial Aviation, part of the Aviation Week group, and he's publisher at jetwine.com.
Hey, good evening to everybody. And wow, this actually is 2022, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
You sound so excited.
I just wanted to check. I thought maybe I'd missed it.
Nope, not yet anyway. Also with us is David Vanderhoof, our aviation historian. Hey, David.
Happy New Year, everyone. Just remember Soylent Green is people.
Oh,
because
no.
That took place in 2022.
Did it really?
It did.
Wow. That was a great movie. Is that Charlton Heston?
Yes.
And Edward G. Robinson.
Oh, yeah.
You guys are just a
I don't know.
Fountains
of knowledge. I remember more useless facts than I can imagine.
Has our guest run away yet?
Not yet. Let's introduce him before he does.
Well, wait a minute. Welcome to the Movie Trivia Podcast.
Yeah, right. Our guest this episode is Pete Zaccanino. He's the CEO of aircraft management company Park City Aviators. He's also a four-time air racing gold champion in the jet sport class. He's an author. He's a speaker, a former aerodynamics professor, and an Embry-Riddle graduate. Now, Pete has flown over 23,000 hours in more than 270 aircraft types, and he's flight tested over 685 aircraft. Pete, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Thanks for having me, guys. This is awesome. I've been looking forward to this.
Well, you know, it sounds like you eat, breathe, and sleep aviation. What is it? Is it the thrill, the rush, or something else?
No, it's definitely something else. I'm not the thrill-seeking type, actually. The resume kind of sounds that way when I ponder it for a minute, but it's more about the accountability, the intensity. I like concentration exercises of that nature. I guess you could sum it up, it's a little bit zen-like, maybe.
Well, that makes sense. I can appreciate that. Well, we're going to explore some of those things coming up with Pete, but first we've got some aviation news from the past week. Are you guys ready?
Ready from the West.
Ready from the Midwest.
Ready from the Mid-Atlantic, since I got corrected from about the South last week.
Yeah, not far enough South.
Last year. So ready from the Mid-Atlantic.
All right, let's get started. Our first item comes from CNN. I think everybody's seen this in the news. Holiday flight cancellations soar with COVID-19 disruptions and bad weather. And we've seen thousands of flights being canceled during this very busy travel season. According to the article on January 1st of this year, 2022, FlightAware showed more than 4,700 flights canceled globally. Thousands more cancellations followed on January 2nd. And looking at the FlightAware data, CNN says airlines canceled more than 14,000 flights in the last 10 days. Bad weather and employees being tested positive for COVID are credited with causing the disruptions. But what a start to a new year. What do you guys think this means for commercial aviation.
It can only get better.
Yeah, it can't get worse.
And Rob, I'm looking at this. Chicago O'Hare, 44% flights canceled on Saturday, quarter canceled on Sunday, Midway 54% canceled. Did you guys have a snowstorm? What's going on out there?
Yeah, we did. We had a major snowstorm, actually, and it was producing lots of snow and a little bit of ice in there, and everything was just kind of frozen up by Sunday morning. First storm we've had the entire winter season.
Well, the airlines certainly have handled storms, weather, lots of delays, cancellations in the past, lots of equipment and personnel in the wrong places. And they have methods for returning the system back to where they'd like to see it. But and I don't know where this past week stacks up in the grand scheme of, you know, historical disruptions. But do you think that the airlines are going to try to compensate for this, or is this just the status quo for them? I mean, are they? Do you think they'll be looking for increased flexibility to handle these disruptions? Do you think they'll look at things like, well, you know, who knows when the employees could all be affected by this or some other pandemic? So let's use more technology to automate and replace humans. I don't know. Do you think things are going to change, or do you think this is just, you know, here we go again and we'll go this way the next time?
I see a lot of head shaking. No, I think this is business. This is kind of normal for them, isn't it?
Well, it's worse now because they have the flight crews that are testing positive in places, and that cuts down their availability even more. Of course, now I understand the quarantine process. The length of it has changed. They're trying to shorten it, and I think they're doing that simply for the economics of it. I don't think there's any data out there that says that it's necessarily safer. But again, all that stuff combined is just overwhelming to these people. They were in a tizzy before this month, actually, say before Thanksgiving. So this is not making them feel really good at all.
Well, January is kind of seasonally slower for them anyway, so I'm guessing they will catch up. It's probably going to take several days to get all the planes back in the different places where they need to be. I think that with the high levels of COVID that we're starting to see, and you know, I just looked at my data for my county locally, and the number of cases is almost as high as it was this time last year. I can't believe we're, you know, seeing that. I have a feeling that that's going to impact traveling again. So I think we're probably going to see a lot of discounting from the airlines to try and get people back into those seats. And, you know, the planes have been fairly full lately. So I guess the good news is there's probably going to be a little extra, you know, a few extra empty seats you know, in the weeks ahead here.
How about the impact on air travelers? I mean, I run across a lot of people, it seems, in the last month, let's say, that are kind of giving up on air travel, and they're driving longer distances by car, or in some cases just not traveling at all. That's kind of understandable. Do you think this is a temporary shift, or possibly the traveling public maybe will, you know, move on to other modes?
I think they already have. If you look at the increase in business aviation use, you can't buy a previously owned jet to save your life. I mean, normally the used airplane market, there's 10, maybe 12% of the fleet that's up for sale normally. I think if I remember something I saw from Brian Foley, who follows these issues, it was down to something like 2, maybe 3% of the airplanes are available, which isn't much, which means there are way more people that want them than can get them. And of course, it's easy to figure out why. I mean, you own a business airplane, or you have access to one. You drive to the airport. They let you out on the ramp with your car. The poor the junior pilot usually loads all the bags, and off you go. There's no well, let's see. We've got to wait for the pilots to show up, and you know, we don't have the catering on board yet, and we've got a little mechanical here. I mean, those do happen, but not very often. And again, people in the last year have just eaten this up, and I have a feeling it's only going to become more useful to them, especially the high net worth people that usually would have flown first class or at least business class on the airlines, because they don't want to put up with all this anymore.
Couple quick data points. I know of two people just in the last couple months. One was about 2 weeks ago, who called me and said, hey, I want to learn how to fly. Both of them have already placed orders for brand new Cirrus aircraft, you know, $1 million. One of them hasn't even had their first flight lesson yet. And I just heard that, he's, put the order in. So there are a lot of people who are kind of looking at alternatives. partially, I think it's pandemic driven. There may be other, factors as well. And then just less than a week ago, I was in Southern California doing some work, and I had flown down to Burbank and then drove an hour to where I needed to be working with a jet owner. When I came back, my wife had said, I really don't want you on the airline. So I just thought, what the heck? I drove home. It was 5 hours. It would have been four if I'd driven the hour to Burbank, waited, and all that kind of stuff. And you know what? I kind of enjoyed it. It was a fun change of pace just to, be in the car, see some scenic countryside and so on. And that's rare for me. But yeah, I think people are kind of making the decision sometimes. It's like, I think I'll avoid the airlines.
Yeah, we've had tremendous number increases in people that normally do not look at private air travel. And the interesting fact over the last 20 years is somewhere in the low teens, call it 12% to pick a number, of the people that can actually afford a private aircraft for transportation are the ones that buy it. I mean, that's a tiny number. And we've seen that number double in the last 12 months, and that's a huge impact. And like you guys were saying earlier, the aircraft available right now are slim pickings, and a lot of them are unfavorable aircraft. We've turned down a couple aircraft in pre-buys because they weren't compliant, and we didn't want to have anything to do with them. But we are paying a premium for the aircraft we're acquiring because we're picking from the top of the heap. And the other thing that's been happening is back-channel deals where it's jets being sold that aren't even on the market yet. So they're not even entering into the data pool. I just get phone calls, or I call my peers and say, hey, we need a Falcon or whatever the aircraft. And they're like, oh, we might be selling this because we have a new plane or whatever the case may be. And so those don't even enter the data pool except in the sense on the FAA registry because they're not part of the marketing and et cetera. But I think people are tired of the process that's going on, and they've realized it's not as expensive to own a private aircraft, relatively speaking, as it used to be. I mean, you can buy a plane that sold for $50 million 10 years ago, you can buy it for $8, $9 million right now, even in this seller's market. And we've never seen anything like this, as we all know. It's unprecedented. And it's trickled down to other things. People are using a Cirrus as a corporate aircraft, as opposed to just, the private owner operator type of aircraft.
And this sounds like a permanent shift, because it's almost an awareness thing. People are becoming awareness of this alternative, and they like it. And it doesn't sound like something where they'll say a year from now to whenever, I almost said whenever this is over, but at some point in the future to say, it's okay now, I'm going back to commercial. I don't think that's going to happen.
I think it's a permanent shift until the stock market tanks. I think there are a lot of folks that are flush with money, and if and when, and I'm sure it's when the economy turns down hard, then we're going to see people back off on these purchases. That's what I think. What do you think, Pete?
I think there's a lot of truth in that, Max. The only thing I would add to it is the market has helped with the purchase of aircraft. But the other thing has been the cash purchases. They're not liquidating an asset or a stock or a position to buy it. They're just going to the bank and saying, hi, I need, $9 million, $10 million for a closing tomorrow. And I'm being a little glib. But we haven't, in our observation, we haven't seen the new buyer that's never had a jet liquidating some form of equity or otherwise to make the purchase. And that's the only difference I see from the interest rates going up or the economy changing, is that aspect, which you know, I hate to sound that way, but there's a lot of people that aren't as affected by, you know, the economy. They're already where they want to be in life, and the economy just alters it slightly. And it'll be interesting what the next 2 years look like, that's for sure. But I do think we've had a change in people's perception of aviation, and it's now more attainable than it's ever been, in my opinion.
Another couple of events that have affected people's perception, perhaps, of aviation, or at least of Boeing, maybe, or maybe the 737 MAX, is the accidents with Ethiopian and Indonesia. And we see now that both Ethiopia and Indonesia are returning the 737 MAX to service. Ethiopian Airlines says it will resume flying its Boeing 737 MAX jets starting February 1st, 2022. They have four of those. The CEO of the airline said, "We have taken enough time to monitor the design modification work. With more than 20 months of a rigorous recertification process, we've ensured that our pilots, engineers, aircraft technicians, cabin crew are confident on the safety of the fleet." Indonesia is lifting their ban effective immediately, and some of their statements almost sound like they collaborated with the Ethiopians, because the executive language that they use is very similar. Those are probably, I don't want to say the last holdouts, but, you know, with those two and with China now also, I guess, resuming flights of the 737 MAX, it's, you know, maybe there's a page being turned in that book.
I wonder how many are still left sitting on the ramp. Boeing certainly had a large inventory of deliveries that they had to hold on to. I would have to imagine those are getting whittled down a little bit, but I would imagine they still got some that you know, haven't delivered yet.
I'm sure Isaac could tell us.
I haven't seen the numbers myself, only, you know, the classic pictures. You fly over some of the airports that were storing them, and there's definitely less, but I don't know what the actual number is myself.
Yeah, that would be interesting to see what they're – because we talked about that, I don't know, a year ago maybe, is, you know, the amount of time that it's going to take – it would take to work that that backlog of aircraft back into service and all. Yeah, we should take a look and see what progress Boeing is making.
But you'll also find that in countries like Ethiopia, Indonesia, the usage of business aviation airplanes, corporate airplanes, is much less than it is in North America and in Western Europe. And really, I know that even Asia has as in China has kind of reduced its dependency on business aviation, but otherwise it's going great guns. And I think that as long as, you know, somebody mentioned recession or stock market or something, I think that as long as people who are able to afford that lifestyle feel like they're doing well, they'll continue. And if for some reason something changes that they think the world is coming to an end, they may revisit that. But I don't see any, because now they're used to it. It's like having somebody pick you up for work every day, and you don't have to drive anymore, and you can sit in back and read the newspaper and have a cup of coffee and talk to your friends on the phone and answer a few emails. I mean, who wouldn't like to be driven here, there, and whatever? And I think that's, you know, that for a long time, that has been business aviation's big selling point. Hmm.
Yeah, that's something that you should be able to relate to, Rob. I mean, when you go to work, you just have to walk across your backyard.
Well, I think I said this before, but there, you know, for people like us, or us, is there somebody else here besides me? I don't think there is. But for people like me who spent a long time working in the corporate world flying, there's no greater hell in the world than putting a corporate pilot at an airline airport and saying, okay, you're going to join everybody else and wait in line. And the groans, just even to get home, we just didn't want to do it.
Sure. All right, 5G. You know, we've been talking about 5G every week now for, I think, 3 weeks anyway. And I'll be honest with you, the first time we talked about this issue, I thought, well, this speed is sort of in passing and, you know, it's not going to be a long-running story, but it's turning out to be just the opposite. And we're looking at a report in Reuters. AT&T and Verizon CEOs reject U.S. request for 5G deployment delay. Well, there was request by the Transportation Secretary and the FAA Administrator to AT&T and Verizon to delay the deployment scheduled for January 5th, 2022. And, of course, if you've missed the last couple of episodes and haven't been watching the news, the issue is that the FAA and many airline groups are concerned about the proximity of the frequencies, the portion of the spectrum used by 5G, and it being adjacent to the radar altimeter frequency. The FCC and the wireless carriers don't think that there is a problem. And they were asked to delay it, and they responded with, nope, they're not going to delay it.
Well, and they also said, give us two more weeks. And now maybe the media is not reporting it, but we haven't heard what is going to change in the next 2 weeks that would cause anybody to think anything differently from what they think now.
The FAA has put out a draft NOTAM of what NOTAMs might look like once the 5G is turned on. And they're basically, letting airmen know that these are the kinds of limitations and functions that won't be available at certain airports. And it does affect a large number of, major airports. And of course, probably the biggest use for the radar altimeter that can be affected by 5G is for ILS approaches to really low minimums or autoland. And so you think about it, that's probably not something you want to interfere with. If you're landing in weather that's so bad that you have to use the autoland capability, you really don't want anything interfering with your radar altimeter, because that's an absolutely key part of making that whole system work.
Yeah, we've been – go ahead.
No, I was just going to correct Mr. Trescott on his terminology.
Okay.
It's a effective January 1st. It is not a notice of airmen, is it?
Oh yeah, that's right. It's still a NOTAM. And actually, I didn't use the full acronym. I just said to notify airmen. But yeah, go ahead. What is the new acronym?
Air missions.
Yep. Notice the air missions. Right.
Yeah, we're changing what the acronym stands for, even though it's the same acronym.
Yeah. Oh, that's fine. But just we want to be precise on our language these days.
Absolutely.
Well, and of course, the NTSB has been on FAA's case for years about shaping up the NOTAM program. And what we found out now from a secret source I found is that the stumbling block – why are you smiling, Max?
Your secret source?
We're waiting to hear this one. We don't know if it's a joke or real, but go ahead.
We learned that the real problem was FAA trying to come up with some kind of a word to replace the man part of the NOTAM that would make any kind of sense at all. And it's not so easy.
No, but I think they've got a great solution to that. I wonder who came up with that, who thought of that, because it – notice that the air missions is all inclusive, and I think that's great.
I think they use that same software that everybody else has been using in the drug world for years to name the latest product, which is just a series of letters in some fashion that meant absolutely nothing to anybody at all, and now it means this thing, a new drug for your arthritic pain or something. But that's just what my source told me. I, of course, cannot confirm that.
or deny. I did. You know, I
or,
did.
Or deny.
Yeah, yeah. I'll hold it for later, but I did learn why drug names are the way they are? Because I got curious. The same thing, you know, you're thinking, where do they come up with these wacko names? Well, there's a reason for it, it turns out.
We got several ADs for our jets about we have to insert a new limitation into our paperwork about the cannot do Cat 2 or Cat 3 approaches, et cetera, et cetera.
Hmm.
I feel safer, by the way.
Good. Yeah.
Well, so you feel like safer because now you don't have to fly to really low minimums, or you're safer because you're not having to worry about 5G interference?
No, because I got more paperwork.
Got it. Well, doesn't that affect the weight and balance of the airplane to put in more paperwork?
Yes.
And to think he said he wasn't funny at the top of the show. And he couldn't make a joke.
Oh, dear. So, you know, we've been hearing that the 5G networks in Europe have been using, you know, operating without any apparent issue. And there's a little bit more information about that. AT&T and Verizon, they say they're not going to deploy 5G around airports for 6 months. Sorry, that's still in effect. But the exclusion zone that AT&T and Verizon are proposing, they say, is currently in use in France with a slight adaptation. That's a quote. Reflecting, quote, modest technical differences in how C-band is being deployed. And the CEOs of AT&T and Verizon, in their response to the request that they delay this, said the laws of physics are the same in the United States and France. If U.S. airlines are permitted to operate flights every day in France, then the same operating conditions should allow them to do so in the United States. Now, what's new to me is the FAA saying that, yeah, well, but France uses a lower power level for 5G, and the 5G spectrum there sits a little bit farther away from that used for radio altimeters, so that there is, you know, some difference. So I guess the saga continues. I don't know who's doing what next to try to resolve this. But I imagine we'll be talking about it again pretty soon.
Yeah. And it's so misleading to describe this as being a 5G problem when you figure 5G is being used on a huge number of frequencies totally across the spectrum. You know, T-Mobile's got it down on the 600 megahertz range, which is about as far away as you can get from the radar altimeters, up around 4.2 gigahertz. And so it's really the particular frequencies that certain carriers are using. So this is a C-band issue. So the frequency is up around 3.8 gigahertz.
And, you know, I have to give credit to the national news. I think it was NBC, but I could be wrong. But at the conclusion of the report on this topic just tonight, they finished off by saying that this is not an issue with your phones, right? They wanted to make it clear that this is an issue around the towers and not an issue with your phone, so you don't need to be worried about 5G on your phone and what it might be doing. I thought that was pretty good. All right, something a little different. This is from The Drive. F-35s could get new engines as soon as 2027. This story is a month old, but it's still kind of interesting. The U.S. Air Force is pursuing several what they call future initiatives, and it includes things like lifting wing bodies and different propulsion for UAVs and something that sounds really scary. I don't know what it is. The Megawatt Tactical Aircraft Program, the MWTA. I don't even know what that is. And they're even looking at air wake surfing. Right? We've seen that before. Just like geese, you know, surfing the wake of the goose in front of you. Well, this article in The Drive is looking specifically at one of these future initiatives, which is called the AETP, the Adaptive Engine Transition Program. And sort of the simple way to think about this is that generally jet engines have two airstreams, right? One through the core and also a bypass airstream around the core. Well, these AETP engines are adaptive with three streams. And the military application is that third stream can be dynamically modulated between the, core stream and the bypass stream. And so that gives you increased thrust in the combat environment and increased fuel efficiency during cruise. So typically, military engines are optimized around thrust, right? They have generally a small bypass ratio. They're focused on thrust. They don't really care too much about fuel efficiency, and that's why we have these low-bypass turbojets used in fighters, for example. Whereas commercial engines are designed around fuel efficiency, and that's why we see high-bypass turbofans. So this is kind of a hybrid, something that can transition between kind of those two concepts. And prototypes are being developed by GE and Pratt & Whitney. The GE prototype is the XA-100, and the Pratt & Whitney prototype is the XA-101. And they are looking to get big improvements in fuel efficiency, more thrust, better thermal management. And the big thing, all of that together, increasing the range of the F-35 by around 30%. So, David, do you think, is this something that we're going to see? This sounds like something that could be really expensive if they're talking about replacing current engines on F-35s and producing future F-35s with this different engine. Do you think we'll see this?
Yeah, I mean, for all of those critics out there, the words they're hearing is, let's make the F-35 even more expensive. But the fact that the F-35 only has one engine is kind of... If I see this happening, I think the Air Force is going to probably take both engines, and then I don't know what that does to the naval program, and it definitely cannot touch the F-35B program because you need the fan in that engine. So it's tough. Range is important. And the F-35 is not lacking range. It's not like an F-18 where it's got severe range issues, but it's got range issues. So, I mean, if you're going to improve the aircraft and make it last for the 21st century, you've got to keep improving it. And aircraft went through lots of engine changes, like Phantoms went through engine changes, and the F-15s have gone and F-16s have gone through major engine changes and overhauls and upgrades. So it's not unplausible. It's just, it depends upon how economical it is. Does it save in the long run, or at least stay reasonable in the long run? You know, because federal government programs don't ever save money, really. But maybe it will look better down the road. Interoperability, we'll see. But if the F-35, again, is going to be around till 2022, you know, it's going to need to be upgraded. Engines are the one thing they haven't really talked about before because of the specific mission requirements of all three airframes. But if the Air Force is taking this and running it on its own, we'll see how it affects the other programs.
We have a video. We'll put a link to that in the show notes. It's a GE video on their XA-100 adaptive cycle engine. And it kind of gives you a little look at how these things operate. So it's interesting. But I guess, one of the points that you're making, David, is that especially with military aircraft, these things are not static. They are continuously improving, sometimes in major ways, like a different engine. But that's not unusual at all. But the investment is pretty significant. And here you see both Pratt & Whitney and GE being funded to do this development work. So here again, you know, you've got the competition between the two companies, but you're spending twice the development money since you've got two participants inventing how to do this.
And let's face it, even in the civilian world, we had the 737 MAX and the A320neo. I mean, those are complete re-engining. I mean, so it's not uncommon in aviation. It gets thrown next to the F-35, which means that there's going to be controversy with it. Whereas engine upgrades across the board from all aircraft is normal.
Yeah, but in the civilian world, the cost of the motor is a significant part of the decision. Whereas in the military, do they care what it costs? Because I kind of get the impression sometimes that they don't.
Well, do they care what it costs? Yes. Well, okay, the military may not care, but there's that white building on the end of the mall that does. And
is that the Target?
What?
Is that the Target?
Yeah, we're not going to go that route. But there are requirements, you know. And believe it or not, the Pentagon does occasionally pay attention to cost. We have canceled a lot of programs that have been canceled precisely for cost overruns. But usually that's because of pressure from Congress. So, I mean, there isn't unlimited funds out there. So, yes, they do. And that is why the reason why they are going with two programs. To see competition breeds a better engine at probably the same cost. So, or you do what they did with like the F-16 and now the F-15, where you've got both engine companies competing every day for the next fighter, even though they're replacing on the F-16, the F-100 and the F-101. I mean, Pratt & Whitney and GE both build engines for that airframe, and they compete for lowest cost. So, I mean, I can see the Pratt & Whitney and GE doing this for the F-35 because that's going to be the predominant jet aircraft in the U.S. military for decades to come.
But the Air Force pays for all the development costs, doesn't it?
Not always, no. Depends on the contract. Some contracts, it's joint. Some the Air Force pay for. And every now and then, the manufacturers just come up with an idea and go for it, hoping it'll sink
take
or swim.
Off.
Look at the F-20. It was a great airplane, but, you know, it didn't make it.
Right.
Yeah, and Textron, the owner of Lycoming and Cessna, has what, the Scorpion, which is a jet that they've developed for the military that I don't think anybody's purchased, certainly not in the U.S. I don't know that they have any sales outside the U.S. either.
No, there has not been any as of yet that I know of.
All right. Well, again, we're speaking with Pete Saccanino. I'm going to talk about Reno first, since you know more than a little bit about that. So I've always had it in my head that I need to go to the air races someday, maybe someday soon or some year soon. And I suspect that many listening to this are also of the same mind. So as a competitor, as someone who's been to the races many times, what can you tell us about what we should know about the air races and, you know, how do we take the best advantage of the time that we might spend visiting that?
I think one of the coolest parts to the air race event is the how up close and personal you can get with the majority of the teams. And they're busy. I mean, we're super busy. My team is running around all the time working on just different things and preparations, et cetera. But they – you know, we have a strict policy, strict being a loose word, I guess. But, you know, if the kids come up, we stop. We welcome them. We show them the planes, put them in the planes, you know, et cetera. Because you can get right involved with the pit area and pre-race stuff and, you know, the parade of planes going out to line up for the start and the whole experience. So I think it's more it's just a more intimate event when it comes to the air show situation that goes on out there, and for good reasons. We need protected areas. But, you know, with over 100 racers going on in 6 classes, there's a lot of interaction for the general public to have during the event. And some of it that's really special is actually when all of us racers show up, but the fans haven't per se, the event hasn't started officially because we're doing qualifications, tech inspections, briefings, and a whole bunch of things. They really can get some behind the scenes insights because it's for the racers, it's a 10-day competition or a 10-day event rather. And that's a very unique animal, you know, compared to, your standard air show, your military air show, or when you go to events like Farnborough or Paris or Dubai air shows. It's a very, very specific type of an event that's different, and I think it's one of my favorites. Well, I've been doing it for quite a while, so it's got to be a favorite of mine.
Can you define the age of kids that you have in the pit area?
Rob wants to know if he still qualifies.
No, Rob, you do still qualify. We're very welcoming. I can't speak for every team, but I think that's a very typical attitude from the racers to the public, is that most of the racers are very welcoming to everybody. Whether it's been the Tuskegee Airmen visiting us and we've brought them in to share the experience, or they have school day, basically, where a lot of the local schools bring hundreds of, 6 to 14-year-old kids and older for that matter. And it's really awesome. We have this family that has been visiting my pit since the kids were, I'm guessing, 3 and 5 years old, roughly. Mm. And they have come every year with a notebook. And every year I've been signing that notebook, and they go out and chase after all the other teams. And they've been doing it consistently. So we included them at one of the performer or racers events during the week, just to thank them for being so supportive. But it was absolutely awesome to watch them grow up, literally. I mean, now they're middle, upper teenagers, roughly. And so that type of, I think, environment is unique to aviation, especially in the times we're in right now.
Pete, what's the makeup of the team crew like? What are the specialties or talents or functions of the team members?
Sure. Most years we race in two classes. I race in the sport class and jet class. Not every year, but most of my years it's been two classes. And each plane has a crew chief, and he's the boss. Then I have the team manager, who's my brother, and John runs around just dealing with logistics. It's a horrible job, but he seems to like it, and I'm not sure why. But, we invite everybody, both in the business sense and the other sense, friends and family. We just tell everybody, show up, and we'll get you tickets and figure it out, when you get there. And so my brother runs around taking care of that as the team manager, a lot of that at least, and little things too. Then we have support mechanics in each aircraft, and sometimes it's running to National Auto Parts Association and picking up some things that we need, getting nitrogen because we ran out of nitrogen for whatever, or working on a plane if we have a problem, or helping another team if they have a problem. And we'll loan our folks. We have people that have volunteered in our team for food because it's a big part of it. We're there from literally the first briefing at 7:30 until the last racer on deck, which is about 5:30 on a minute-by-minute schedule. And they just show up in the two pits with food for the team and myself, and hydration is super important. And then we have some marketing folks. Then we have aircraft cleaners. Again, we try to get some of the youth involved to just give them a rag and some wax or a cleaner to keep the plane and the bugs off. And we do a lot of that type of interaction as well over the years. But we have a consistent core that's been with me for all 17 years. I think it's 17, something like that, of about 20 people. And then we have some people that just can't make it every year, but they do their best too. And because it's all volunteer based. I wish I was a billionaire, could pay them all a lot of money, but I'm not. It's aviation. I work in aviation.
Yeah. Well, I imagine sponsorships are a big part of this.
Yeah, I'm not very good at it. Yeah. If anybody wanted to help us be sponsored, that would be awesome. But we've had help, and it's super appreciated. But it's tough. We've always said, well, the Kentucky Derby is a single event, and Reno is a single event. But the Derby gets a lot more attention than we do, and hopefully that'll change. I mean, air racing used to be a very romantic event that went on around the country, and I'm sure David can add to that discussion. But it was the who's who to be at the championships or at some of the other events. It was Hollywood and all those types of socialites that used to come to the races. And, something's changed in our culture, I guess, but it's just my favorite event.
And describe the airplanes a little bit for us.
Sure. So there's six classes at Reno, and you have the Formula One class, which is I keep saying I want to race in just because I think it's cool. They have as an aeronautical engineer, I appreciate what they do to get their planes fast. They can only use a Continental O200 and the same engine as a Cessna 150.
Wow.
That's all they can use. They don't have a choice. Hmm. They have a minimum wing area that they have to adhere to, and they have a minimum weight area. So they have to work in some parameters. I'm sure they have others. Again, I've never raced in it. And they wind up, their props are turning at 4,000 plus RPMs in the Formula One class to get the speeds they get.
Wow.
And, their fast guys are in the gold are doing upwards of 280 plus miles an hour. So they're pretty impressive from the engineering side. Then we have the biplane class, which is there's a lot of pit specials there, single seat pits that have been super modified. But there's also been some very unique designs that are extremely fast. And both of those two classes, they race early in the morning to keep out of the wind, and they race on the smaller course. I'm guessing it's somewhere in the 3.5 mile perimeter. Then we have the T6 class, which is, you guessed it, T6 airplanes, and one of the noisemakers in the group, and they have, again, very specific requirements. They can't clip wings and a lot of things like that. Again, I'm not familiar with. The sport class, class I started racing in, they amateur build airplanes. It can't be a prototype. It has to have sold some kits to be eligible. Common in that class is Lance Air Legacy, Glass Airs. Both have been winning aircraft, and other airplanes. We have a big contingency of RV guys, which are really great. And we're in the over 400 mile an hour club in a home built airplane, which is awesome.
Yeah.
Then we have the unlimited class, which is typically the Mustangs and the like Dreadnought and the Sea Furies that are racing out there. And then we have the jet class, which is my other class. The jet class is prior military, mostly trainer types. There's a lot of things you can't do. You can't clip wings or control surfaces like you can in the unlimited class. We finally allowed modern engines in the class, which is great, and it's allowed me to win twice in one of my jets in that class. And my plane's well over 500 miles an hour, and that's an 8 mile course. And my current jet racer is an L29 with a big motor that we pretty much doubled the thrust output with the new motor in it. And then I've been working for a long time on a Super Legacy that I've raced, didn't do well, and I knew it wasn't. And we've been doing things over the winter months. Mm. Let's put it that way.
Mm. Well, it all sounds incredibly exciting. And have any of you guys been to the air races?
No, I never have. I think it would be. Have you heard of any podcasters out that way at the show? Pizza.
No, but you guys are all invited as my guest, and I mean that genuinely. We'll put you in the pit. We'll give you a rag or a wrench as appropriate and put you to work.
That's fine.
And feed you.
That's fine. I'll wipe the bugs off.
I mean, it's a needed task, right? And you're genuinely, I would welcome all of you and, make that happen for you.
That's in September?
Yeah, it's right around the 2/3 marks of September. Typically somewhere in the halfway through September. It just depends on the calendar.
Something I don't understand from a pilot's perspective is that if you're racing, say you're the Vampire, is that what you race?
I raced the Vampire 1 year successfully, and then I crashed it the next year.
Okay, so that would be unsuccessfully.
Well, it depends how you look at it. Rob, it depends how you look at that.
But, if you have an airplane that's moving 500 miles an hour, I mean, that's what, 7-8 miles a minute, and the course is 8 miles, doesn't everything at the height that you fly at, a couple of hundred feet off the ground, doesn't everything just look like a blur? How can you even see the next pylon coming up to know when to turn?
Yeah, I mean, in the 500 mile an hour club, we're doing roughly 770 feet per second. okay, give or take the actual speed, because I've had laps that were much faster. I've had some laps at 550, depending on conditions. And I actually use cues on the course, and when I'm teaching, I give all my secrets to everybody. Well, not all. Let's not be silly about this.
You gotta hold back some,
yeah. But on the course, I teach them everything about wind and how it affects your course line. And there are, to answer your question, there are cuts in the desert that have been there forever. There's a bush at one turn. There's some dirt paths I use, and I use those as markers to indicate where I'm going to make my turns. And if the wind shifts into a high wind condition out of the west, I change where my left wing is going to be over that bush. And things of that nature. And so, and you don't want to be tight to every pylon, or you're going to have a slow lap. So there's times where you go wide and, you know, I'm counting my timing, and it's not a blur because you're not looking right down, right? I'm looking like three pylons ahead, and plus I'm looking for traffic that I'm either passing or lapping or whatever the case may be. And I typically fall, the top of the course is 250 feet. I can't be above 250. And I'm right around the 75 to 110 foot range, depending on the position on the course at the time.
Okay, I'll watch this from the ground.
And how many turns is it?
Well, I mean, in the high speed, you're in a continuous turn. You never are out of the turn. You're just varying your bank angle. And so there's 10 pylons that it's not a circle and it's not an oval on the unlimited course. It's, you know, roundish shape, and there's parts that appear as a straightaway-ish, but I'm just banked up. It's just varying bank angles at the various points on the turn. You know, there's times you go past 90 degrees of bank because you need to make a correction or something happened atmospherically, and it's better to use the bank angle for your correction than the pull G's. We're already pulling G's. If you pull more G's, that slows you down. And so you just want to vary your bank angle accordingly to change your lift vector.
And I was just thinking, you probably have the traffic alerting system turned off. Otherwise, it would be traffic. Yeah.
No, that's how I pass.
Pull up.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
That's fantastic. That just sounds so exciting. How do you transition between that and managing corporate jets? That sounds kind of dry by comparison.
No, I mean, you know, it really isn't. And
his clients get to their places really quickly.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah.
And David, I appreciate that comment. Thank you for that plug. We get there faster than anybody else. You know, it's just a different challenge. Obviously, it's more academic in some ways. But, you know, because we do from the smallest thing to the biggest thing in the management of the jet. And it takes it's a big team that makes all that happen. And our customers are super happy because it's seamless to them. And it's a very intimate business, at least for us it is, where you really know the customer. It's more than just, I don't have a good comparison, but it's very different. It's very intimate. And you do things for them that are very personal. And I think it's the best way to put at it. So, it's, you know, we're not flying at 100 feet going really fast, but it also is pretty cool. You know, pretty cool to do round-the-world trips and big adventures with them where you're really setting up more than just the airplane. And it's very rewarding. And they're also appreciative and happy. You know, they're like, wow, we just got to do this. You know, and they're just like, that was fantastic. You know, that type of stuff.
Well, maybe describe sort of the scope of the service and how that's different from fractional ownership, for example.
Yeah, sure. Some of our customers, prior fractional owners I like when they have that experience. But if they are a prior fractional owner, they have a very strict budget and costs. And I think it gets old for them to be paying those type of writing those checks all the time. And they kind of own the plane. It's a piece of the plane as opposed to when they buy their own airplane, we set it up for them and they help set it up. You know, they have their own blankets. They have their own place to put their dog. They have the snacks they want, the drinks they want, and all those personal things and personal touches. And but the way it typically happens is I'm introduced to a customer, and it's usually word of mouth for us. And we figure out, using math and engineering, honestly, we figure out what plane is going to suit their mission. And if they have a 600-mile mission and five passengers, you know, we look this way, we describe some things. And, you know, if they just come down and say, Pete, I want a Gulfstream. I don't really care if it's efficient or not. And then that's fine. You know, it makes it easier. But usually we're helping them determine what makes sense for them. And then in that, we discuss if there's tax advantages, for example, and we have a team of tax people that help them with that if they need it. And we determine if new makes sense, how they're going to structure it on the business side, or if we go to the secondary market for the purchase. And we know the markets very well. We know the industry very well. And my team is fantastic. And we go out and get them the best deal. And if it's a new plane, it's the best warranty possible, the best features possible, and the things that sometimes get missed. And if we're buying on the secondary market, we're all about trying to get them the best opportunity in the current market. And when we nail the plane down, then we start the purchase process, the managing, the inspection, the pre-purchase inspection, the contract, the purchase agreement, where to close, tax implications on the state we're closing in, what color they want on striping, should we restripe, should we re-leather, a lot of details like that. And then, is the seller responsible for certain aspects on the maintenance? Then they have to pay for those and negotiating those terms. And then we get to bring the prize home and put a bow on it. And then we shift from the purchasing process, the acquisition process, into the operational side, staffing and the pilots and the maintenance trends and trend reporting and, you know, all the day-to-day for keeping a multi-million-dollar jet safe in the air. That's the quick version. I was trying to be quick, I hope.
No, it was good. You're based in Utah, is it?
Yeah. Park City, Utah.
Park City, Utah.
No, don't tell anybody we're in Park City. This is a secret. We're trying to keep this a secret.
Okay. Yeah. Maybe you guys are Rob's secret source. I tell people, Utah. Boy, I tell people that if I just like suddenly disappear someday and no one knows where to find me, go look in Utah because that's probably where I'll be. So, but your clients are...
They're all over. Yeah. We have several planes based here. We have two offices of our operation here in Utah, but we have jets all over the place. And it's been a bit of our model that we have a satellite set up that's supported by, you know, the home base, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And it's fun. I mean, we have just the coolest people to as customers. I mean, it's great. And, you know, it's so true because we have so many first-time owners in these larger jets. And they're like, God, I wish I did this 5 years ago. And stuff that Max was bringing up earlier in the show. And then you get to take them to Courchevel, France, you know, land nearby Courchevel. And it's so much easier for them and quicker and more efficient. I mean, it's awesome. Yeah, it's good.
And that's why I think that the people that have been touched by this in the last year or so are never going to go back because they've been bitten. And once you have that luxury that you could afford, obviously, why would you go back?
Right. You know, good on them that they can afford it. You know, life's been good to them and they share it. So it's pretty cool.
Yeah. I don't begrudge that at all.
No, exactly.
Pete, what kind of employees do you have? I mean, where do folks come from that you bring into the company?
Well, excuse me, gents. I have a little bit of a cough, and it's not COVID, and you can't get it through a computer anyway.
Okay.
But, you know, we recruit a pretty special person. Part of our culture as a business is the adventure. If folks are looking for just – you know, how many days am I going to do a month and that type of stuff? It's really not our place. We keep our average month to 12 days per pilot. And except on international trips, then that changes. But if we do a big international trip, we just got back from the Middle East not too long ago, then the crew on board and involved, they get significant time off because it was a two-week trip. And but it is an adventure for us. And, you know, if you're not having fun, go do something else. And we want to find the people that want to have fun and they get that small businesses have several hats, and we're trying to get a mission done, and we want to keep safety at the utmost while running efficiently. And our numbers compare well. That's why I like fractional owners to compare to, because if I explain to them our how our numbers work, they're just like, how's that possible? I'm like, well, just go talk to the other 12 customers. They'll tell you how it's possible, you know. Yeah. It's just a better way of doing things sometimes and more efficiently.
And you mentioned you organize tours.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like some official thing. It's just I've been lucky enough to travel the whole world, the whole planet. And I keep these books, you know, even tonight I make notes of my – I got like 40 of these books in my last 20 years of my career that I write. And it's not my logbook. It's just notes. And, you know, I have restaurants in there, a good hotel and all that stuff for the whole planet. And so I know the planet, and I end up taking a lot of my customers on these tours where they're like, you know, to use one customer's example, he's like, let's go tour East Africa. I'm like, okay, well, you don't need to do this. You need to do that. And I give him the opinion of it. And we did. We did, I don't know, I think it was a four-week tour of Africa, flying around and doing cool stuff. You know, we paddled the Zambezi River, and I was the tour guide on the river too, and et cetera. And then that same customer, the next year we did Europe, same thing. I was like, yeah, you don't need a lot of time here, but I give 2 days there, that type of advice, and here's why. And they augmented, of course, but then I took them to Central and South America on another tour. Then we ended up doing a round the world tour looking for unique surf locations, and because I also surf, so I could give them, you know, my opinion on that. And that was a 7-week tour around the world. And that one customer alone, I've taken him, I think the number's 85 countries just for that one customer. And we've done that so many times with other people too, where it's, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 week tour of, you know, location X.
Yeah. Now I see why you started this business, because as I recall, the surfing in Utah is just not that good. I mean, you can go out there to the Great Salt Lake. If you catch the wind just right, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah. The secret's out, Max.
Is there some place that you took a client to that surprised you in some place or in some way?
One customer I took to this island off the coast of the Philippines, and I've been to the Philippines many times, and this island I've never been to, but we had to get permission to land there. There's no fuel and all this stuff, and it was called Saguaro. I might be mispronouncing it, but it was absolutely amazing. The place we stayed was magnificent, not because it was all opulent, and it was very comfortable, but their level of detail was unbelievable. And I even went to market with the chef, because he would always ask, what do you want for, you know, lunch, dinner, breakfast? I was like, I'd like to go to market with you and learn how you pick your fish. And it was just a cool experience. And the whole experience was like that on this island. People were wonderful. The food was just fresh and amazing. And there was some good surfing.
To boot.
Think about what it comes down to when you talk favorably about a place. It's usually history and scenery, food, and the people. You know, there's always little things here and there that makes things different. But those are like the summary points. And as long as no one's shooting at you and the food's good and the people are nice, you know, it's all right.
Yeah, I was worried when you started to tell the Philippines story that there was going to be a shooting type, you know. Nah. Certainly they've had, you know, at various points in time, gorillas in certain parts of the country. And I thought, they went to an island where there were gorillas.
Yeah. We were close to that area, but this island was really separated from there. Hmm.
Did you learn to fly in the military, Pete?
No, I'm classic. I did my private pilot's license while I was doing my engineering degree. And just found a Cessna 150, begged, borrowed, stole, whatever it took, and got that done. And then I figured out if I got my commercial license in a single engine, I could start flying skydivers and start making some money from it. So my first 2 years at engineering and in my undergrad, I was throwing people out of airplanes. And the guy loved it because it was a small drop zone in Florida, Titusville. And he loved it because I was paid per load, right? So I went around trying to motivate the skydivers to get in the airplane. I'm like, no, the weather's coming in. We got to go jump, you know. And he loved it because I was doing more loads than his other pilots. So it was great. And of course, you know, CFI and all that stuff.
So you're a good salesman. That's something
no,
I usually
not terrible.
Well, no, but in that sense, you were right because you were trying to get more people on the plane. So. That's super.
Yeah.
Now you've had some personal aircraft projects in the past.
Oh yeah, yeah. You know, I'm always doing something. Right now, the big thing is a Beech-18 and my Super Legacy. And the Beech-18's torturing me. If anybody has a Beech-18 person who can help me, please call me. Oh God, it's not the plane's fault. That's a long, horrible story, but we're getting there. But the Super Legacy has been just, I built that. I've had a lot of help from my team as well. And I'm just constantly tweaking it, getting it faster. It's fast right now. And I elected not to race it this past September for a lot of good reasons. And it's fast, though. I'm excited to get it on the track. So we'll see.
What was your first project?
First project, recovering my Aranca Champ.
Yeah.
That plane paid for most of my college, and that's a true statement. Hmm. I was given tailwheel lessons for the second part of my engineering degree, and it literally paid for most of my college. Hmm. It was good.
Well, earlier, you said beg, borrow, or steal. And this is an example of how if there's something that you really, really want, you know, bad enough, you can figure out ways to make things happen that just don't seem likely otherwise, you know. It's persistence and, you know, focus on it and figure out a way.
I think that couldn't be truer, you know. Thomas Edison said it. He just did it all the time. It wasn't like he was brilliant. He just constantly did it. Mm. Einstein said the same thing, right?
Yeah.
Not to compare to that. It's just a good takeaway from their comments. You know, just they just did it all the time. And you're going to get good at – my grandmother said it too. She said the only reason I cook well is because I've been doing it for so long.
Yeah.
Now, do you have family that are involved in the business at all?
Zero. No one flies. No one's an engineer. I was the black sheep that went wandering out, and then I escaped.
Yeah. Well, their loss, right? I mean.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think aviation's been awesome. So.
Yeah. So you mentioned that you take notes and you write down things and you know, save things like that. Do I understand that you're working on or you have done a book series?
Yeah, so the first two books have been released, just released the second one in the series about 5 weeks ago now, and doing really well. I'm really, really pleased with its final version. And it's a military spy thriller series about a CIA asset, and I'm about halfway through the third book right now in the writing. And halfway through really isn't halfway through. It means you get done with the book and then you do another 3 months of edit work. And I have a great editor. He's fantastic. And he and I really worked well together. So, the first book's called Relevant. And we basically call the series the Relevant series. And second book is titled The New Cold War. Hmm. And it's been fun. I'm really happy with how they've been moving along and progressing.
Is there a website for the books or just search for them on?
Thanks for that opportunity to plug. It's relevantthebook.com and thenewcoldwar.org. And we have a link on our business website as well. And the easiest way, to purchase them is online through that big A company called Amazon.
And, of course, PC Aviators at pcaviators.com while we're doing links.
Thank you.
Any other little activities that you're involved? I don't know when do you sleep?
I'm a kind of hyper guy, but I'm quiet hyper, I guess is the best way to put it. We're busy. Like the last, the end of this fourth quarter, we were slammed with the second book was coming out. And I wanted to launch it properly and two new planes and closing on a plane and buying a plane is super, super time consuming. We spend about 600 hours per purchase on average.
Really? And, that's incredible. Yeah. That's a lot.
It's a lot of hours.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we do a full on three-dimensional regression study on the market to figure out, you know, what price point we should be. And it takes a lot of time. It's just a lot of time. Hmm. It's good though. And, there's always, we always got all kinds of fun little things going on, you know. and big things.
Very
big
good.
Things.
All right, Pete. Thanks for coming on the show. This is this sounds like a conversation that could go on for quite a while and be just as enjoyable going forward as it has been to get us to this point. I'll just mention that all the links that Pete just mentioned will be in the show notes for this episode, so you can find them there if you can't remember them. And Pete, I'm definitely going to see you in Reno maybe this year. I don't know.
Right.
I have a brother that lives in Nevada, so there's another excuse to come out there this year.
Genuinely, just let me know. We'll make it happen for you. Yeah, no problem at all.
We'll take you up
on that. I was going to say, look at how long it took us to get you to Oshkosh. A couple of years.
Did it take a while, Rob?
Did.
Oh, are you talking about me? Yeah, oh, yes.
Oh, yeah.
I thought
you
were talking about Pete. No.
I'm sure it
took you all too long to get me to Oshkosh, that's for sure. But... Nick, you know.
I see. It's our fault now.
Yeah. All right. Thanks again, Pete.
Thanks, you guys. I really appreciate it. Look forward to it again if it happens.
Cool, right?
Well, I've been clearly leading my life the wrong way. That's all I can say.
I know. Hey.
Can you believe this guy is traveling around the world all the time? It's like, whoa.
It's fantastic. And he actually does have a few other activities, I think, that we didn't even get into. So the man definitely leads an aviation full life, which is he's a great guy too, which is always nice.
And a surfer full life too. I mean, gosh. I mean, that's got to be pretty cool just telling your clients, yeah, and I think we really ought to go to the Philippines.
Yeah.
Or, oh, by the way, the surfing is pretty good.
Yeah. Wonderful. What's up with the geeks? All right. Let's see. Hey, you guys keep collaborating on things, you know, in the background here. It's like you're moonlighting or something with podcasts or something. Well, Trescott, you've been doing that for... When did Aviation News Talk start?
Oh, my gosh. Would you believe we're going to come up on 5 years in April?
I really don't believe it. It doesn't feel – wow.
I know. Yeah. It's just – it's hard to believe it's been going on that long. But, yes, you're referring to episode 214, which I collaborated with Rob Mark on. We just released it, and it was all about that really tragic Learjet crash that occurred in San Diego about a week ago. And it's really interesting. I mean, a lot of people kind of go, oh, yeah, classic stall spin. Oh, yeah, they got slow. But when you really peel back the onion and you look at it very carefully, there was just a whole series of events that led up to it. And so you can kind of really, you know, take a look at the data and see, oh, yeah, here's kind of where they, you know, made a mistake that you might call a red flag where, gee, maybe at this point you might want to just go around or divert to another airport. And here's the second, you know, mistake. And finally they got to the third one, which was a mountain just sitting right in front of them at a very close distance and a couple hundred feet above them. And it's like, oops, you know, at that point they were trapped. And so we really try to, you know, paint the picture so that people who are listening could kind of envision themselves in what really looked initially like, this is going to be an easy flight. Hey, we got 10 miles of visibility. The clouds are fairly high. And then it just kind of unraveled on the trip. By the way, the trip was only 18 minutes long. And, you know, as Rob and I kind of discussed, you know, when you do really short trips in jets, the workload is really, really high. There's just so much that happens. I mean, a typical jet trip, yeah, you're busy on the end. You get up to cruise altitude. Then you may be doing some prep work. And finally, when you come down, you get, you know, pretty busy at the end. But boy, an 18-minute trip, you are really busy the entire time. And it's not clear exactly what point they realized that the weather had gotten, you know, much worse. But they were truly at minimums. They were at the VFR minimums. They were also at the IFR circling minimums. And, you know, the problem is, as pilots, we need to build in extra margin in everything that we do. These guys had zero margin. And when you have zero margin, you have to do everything perfectly. And these guys didn't do everything perfectly. You can point to a couple things from an airmanship standpoint where you go, I wouldn't have done it that way. So fascinating case. You know, my thanks to Rob. It was two full days of work to put it together because it's just that complex of an accident.
And I enjoyed it. I mean, it was very interesting the way we tried to work together to put a format together that would be not only educational but just generally interesting. As Max said, you heard them do this, and then this changed, and then that changed, and in reaction they did this, and by the third item you're already going, you know, this doesn't sound very good, and then you can see how they got themselves into a corner. And Max, was it you that sent that video of somebody going by the hill in VFR?
Yes, there was a doorbell camera which caught the aircraft flying overhead, probably on the order of, you know, 7 seconds before the crash, and it includes, you know, the fireball, which kind of, you know, lit it up at the end. And you can actually hear the you know, the engines increasing power for the last couple of seconds. But at that point, it was just too late. They were too low, too slow, and, you know, they were totally out of options at that point. So, you know, at the point where they probably saw that mountain, yeah, it's highly unlikely that they were going to survive. They, among other things, were overshooting the final anyway. So, you know, they had not started the series of turns early enough. So, again, they really boxed themselves in. One of my listeners just sent me an email today. He mentioned he lives in that area, and he mentioned a number of different points. And the airport, which is Gillespie Field, is located in the town of El Cajon, north of San Diego. And he said that El Cajon in Spanish means the box or the drawer. And in a sense, these guys were really just boxed in by the mountains. And so we looked at all the different options for instrument approaches, and there were just weren't many good options. I don't think I've ever seen an airport where it just had such a high number of restrictions and approaches that just weren't usable for fast aircraft, especially at night. So these guys, they were in a tough situation, and unfortunately they didn't see the early warning signs when they, you know, could have cut out of there.
So that's episode 214 of Aviation News Talk. We'll have a link to that in the show notes. Max, how far do you live from Reno?
Reno is about maybe 170 nautical miles, roughly. If you were to drive there, it's probably a good five-hour drive. The good thing, though, is that Southwest flies there, and it's a very short, you know, probably 50-minute flight, I would guess, to Reno from here, and that includes all the taxi time.
What are you doing in September?
Well, that might be kind of fun. By the way, one thing he didn't mention, what I've always heard from, you know, friends of mine that go to Reno all the time, is bring your earplugs, because apparently it is really, really loud on the ground.
Yeah, yeah.
Unless, of course, you're already deaf.
What? Which you might be from going to many prior Reno shows.
Yeah. Hey, this is a new year, and we got a New Year's message from Brian Coleman. Let's listen to Brian.
Hi, Max and team. As 2021 wraps up, I think many people will be happy to have this year entered into their logbooks so they can close it out. The end of the year also gives us an opportunity to reflect, to look back, and also to look forward on the next adventures that we are going to participate in. Well, this year, I don't want to look back. I only want to look forward. And as such, I have two things I'd like to discuss with you. One is about giving. The other is about sharing. The giving part is to remind people to give and to be generous with their donations. Now, please don't get me wrong. Donations do not need to be the monetary kind, although at the Airplane Geeks, we certainly appreciate them. But I'm talking about any kind of gift that you're willing to give. You can smile at a flight attendant. You can wave to a kid as you taxi past them at the airport. You can help an old person crossing the street. You can let someone at the grocery store cut in front of you when they only have a single item to purchase. Acts of kindness are forms of giving, and they are super easy to do. As for donations, besides cleaning out all your stuff on Boxing Day, you can donate all sorts of things. And one of the things I really like to donate is blood. People who know me will be very surprised by this donation of mine. You see, I hate needles, I hate getting poked, and I see this as one of the worst things I could possibly do. However, there is such a shortage of blood these days, and for me, well, it's worth the pain and suffering to give this life-saving liquid. Therefore, I ask of you to donate as often as possible. I'm sure you won't miss it, your blood will regenerate, and it will help save someone's life, or at least aid them in their care along the way. Quite honestly, it's a pretty good feeling, well, after my arm stops hurting, and well worth the pain and suffering to help someone else. So again, please, I encourage you to give blood if you can. The second item I wanted to talk to you about is sharing. I plan to start on a crazy adventure, and I wanted to share my adventure with you all. You see, I've had an aspirational goal of achieving lifetime 1K status on United Airlines for some time now. Sure, this is dumb. One might say a crazy goal, but it's one of mine, and I've wanted to do it for a while. I'm only about 264,000 miles short of this goal, so I figure all I have to do is fly a bit over 100,000 miles for the next 2 years and I'll achieve my goal. That's pretty cool, I think. Over the Christmas break, I was telling a friend of mine about this goal, and she said, "Why don't you do it as a video blog? You know, document your adventures. Document all the crazy things you'll be doing. All the nice people you meet along the way. All the not-so-nice people you might encounter. Heck, you might even get inspired to finish writing your book about aviation bathroom experiences. Oh, and if you do it in something like 2 or 3 months, now that will really make for a story," she said. So I thought about this for a few minutes and I thought, yeah, you're right. I should document this journey. It will make for interesting airplane geek segments. Well, at least I think it will anyway. Therefore, over the next few months, I'm going to plan out my journey, post some itineraries, book some flights, and get started. It'll be great to have some meetups along the way, and this is the way I'm going to be sharing with you guys, not only the planning, but actually meeting you out in the field, and I think that's going to be great. You will be providing content for the show. Yes, I know it's crazy, but living in these times of COVID, it is proven to me that life is short and should be enjoyed. Yes, I will be as safe as possible, but I want to share this journey with you, our great listeners. I want you to be a part of it. So please provide your feedback to me at brian@airplanegeeks.com, and I'll update everyone as I finalize my plans. And if you think this is a really stupid idea, you can also send an email to iamreallyoffended@yahoo.com. I monitor this email address, and I look forward to hearing from you all. Fly safely, Brian.
Apparently, that's a real email address.
I'm really offended. Wow, I've never heard that.
Yeah, I wonder when he gets there. We could try it. We could send him something offensive. Let's see what happens.
Well, but he's probably overwhelmed with that kind of thing already.
Yeah, that's a good point.
That makes me a little more aware of why he. He mentioned that he's headed to Europe, I think next month or something. Brian, you'll have to tell me about that. But and I wondered what he was going for. Now I think I understand.
Yeah. So it sounds very exciting. Looking forward to seeing what this results in. We wanted to just give a shout out to our donors from last year. Now, as you may know, we have a donate button on the website, where you can make either a one-time or a recurring donation to Airplane Geeks. Helps us pay for all the things that cost money, the media hosting, the website hosting, the Riverside technology that we use to record these episodes, and all the rest of it. But just wanted to give a special shout out to Ed, to Ted, Douglas, Mike, John, Ed, another Ed, Glenn, Robert, Gregory, Stephen, Patrick, Karsten, and Brian. not our Brian, a different Brian. But we want to thank those guys for making financial contribution. We really appreciate it, and it really helps us out. So if you're interested and able to help in that way, just find the donate button on our webpage at airplanegeeks.com. I have a couple of shout-outs that came in from our main man, Micah. Let's see. We have an Australia desk. Maybe we should have a main desk as well or something. Tell them to record these. So this comes from centralmaine.com, Main Instrument Flight. That's the name of a company. Main Instrument Flight, sold to Idaho-based company. And this is about Sprintbach Aviation of Idaho bought Main Instrument Flight. At the Augusta State Airport, they plan to invest in a pilot training program along with the University of Maine in Augusta and in the charter business. And you may recall back in episode 516, which seems like forever ago, our guest for that episode was Greg, the aviation program coordinator at the University of Maine at Augusta. So link back to that. Also, another story, this came from NewsNationNow.com. Late passenger runs onto airfield at Phoenix Airport, attempts to stop plane. And this actually happened. Can you believe this? A woman who didn't want to miss her flight ran out.
And now when they said late passenger, I hope that doesn't mean she got run over by an airplane when she did that.
No, no.
the late woman. Yeah. Now, late means she was late for her flight, not that she has passed away.
That's right. Sorry about that. Yeah, that was, now that you mention it, that was kind of unclear. But apparently, yeah, she was late for her flight. She got to the gate, but the door to the jetway had closed. And then she ran through some double glass doors between the passenger area and the secure airfield, somehow got through that, and then ran down a flight of stairs and tried to get to the plane. So she was arrested as a result of that. There may be some other issues involved, or maybe she just doesn't realize that you can't run out onto the runway to catch your plane. I don't know.
It was probably one of those tough days, and she was running late, and she was just so desperate to get where she was going. Yeah, I'm sure she wasn't thinking straight. I had this visual image of my mind of a commercial from 30-plus years ago for Hertz, which was with O.J. rushing through the terminal, leaping yes. over seats and
that.
Things like that.
Yeah. Another strange one, at least I think this is strange, our listener Todd sent in a video on YouTube. It's called I Crashed My Plane, because that's what he does. He crashes his plane. So I don't know if you guys had a chance to look at this video, because I just popped it into the show plan kind of late. But this gentleman was flying a 1949 Taylor craft, and he was carrying the ashes of a friend who was late in this case, in that sense. Who I guess was a paragliding aficionado. So he was flying someplace with the ashes, and then he was going to paraglide somewhere and sprinkle his friend's ashes. And he's documenting everything. There's a camera in the cockpit. I counted two external cameras on the plane while showing this. And, he's flying the plane and talking about what he's doing. And then all of a sudden, he experiences an engine out. And he appears to be kind of, not very happy about that, a little bit nervous. Now, he's flying over mountains, so he determines that there's no way he can land this plane successfully. So he jumps out the plane with his parachute. As he's free-falling away from the plane, he's got another camera, unless he took the one from the cockpit, I don't know, on a selfie stick, and he's, showing him and the plane, and he deploys his chute. And at this point, I'm starting to think, is this real? Or is this a setup? Well, shortly after that, the cameras on the plane catch it crashing into the ground. He falls into the underbrush, and he's all scraped up and cut up, and he's bleeding. And he actually gets to the plane. He locates the plane. Now, he doesn't say anything about this, but presumably he retrieved the cameras from the plane since we saw that video. And I'm still wondering, gosh, is this all real? Now, he's got no water. There's no phone service there. He hikes out. He's getting desperate. It's getting dark. He hears a cow. And he figures, well, okay, that must be civilization. So he heads toward that. He finds a road, flags down a car, and he's saved. And then several days later, he's hiking up the mountain that he was intending to go to in the first place, spreads the ashes, and he paraglides down. I don't know what to say about this. I did know the comments are turned off. So normally you'd see about 612 snarky and interesting, you know, and laughable comments, but there's, you know, you don't get the benefit of that that entertainment. But I don't know. So his moral of the story is always carry a parachute when you're flying an airplane.
And who sent us this?
Our listener, Todd.
Uh-huh. Okay.
I think the moral of the story is that anytime you want to try and get a viral video, bring along your parachute and your GoPros.
Yeah.
It's interesting. He's got about 250,000 views on that, which to me says, yeah, he's probably made about $1,500. But he's also got multiple videos that have had 2, 3, 4, 5 million views. So he's probably made about 15 grand on those. And it says right there who is sponsoring, you know, his video. I mean, all I can say is if it walks like a duck, quacks like a duck, it's probably a duck. And I think we're looking at a duck here. This does not smell right.
It did seem a little bit off. Another thing is that, so, I mean, he's crashed or he's parachuted into the wilderness, right? There's nothing around him. If you're marooned in the wilderness, you don't start walking. If anything, he should stay with the plane, right? Because that's what's going to be found first when he doesn't show up where presumably he told people he would be showing up. That, I don't know, that seemed kind of funny to walk out like that.
There was a story on AvWeb about this. It was published on Christmas Day.
Oh, really?
And the main point of the story was that the FAA is investigating what looks like a very – like a crash that occurred under extremely suspicious circumstances. And if you read through the comments, a lot of the people who've watched the video – and I haven't. I've just kind of read about it and thought, okay, I don't need to, you know, to read this. But people have pointed out – many, many, many inconsistencies, such as the type of parachute that he was wearing, which was a full complete rig, you know, with the emergency chute and the regular chute, almost impossible to climb into an airplane wearing one of these. Most people who would wear a parachute while flying an airplane would have a much smaller rig than that. They also said that you could see in the video, I haven't seen this, so I don't know, but one of the comments said, you could actually see that there were several long areas, you know, maybe 5,000 feet long, where, gosh, you could have glided this airplane down to a landing. There was nothing compelling about jumping out of the airplane and a lot of other things that were mentioned. But to me, you know, having the presence of mind to have your selfie stick as you jump out of the airplane, that's where, you know, I think it loses all credibility.
Yeah. It had me wondering.
I wonder if the insurance company is going to say the same thing. Remember that guy that put one down in the water about 4 or 5 years ago, and he
That's right.
just happened to have the camera equipment with him to cover the landing and the I should say the arrival and everything that happened after. And people said, you know, this sounds like a bit of a scripted event. This is one of those, but people watch them.
Yeah, that occurred off the coast of California. It was a fairly old Bonanza. And here's where, again, you kind of go, this can't be. It happened that he had arranged for a friend of his to be flying in another airplane, to be flying with him to get air-to-air video. So his friend was able to shoot him as he glided down to the water. And then, of course, he was sitting there in the ocean with his girlfriend as they waited for the Coast Guard helicopter to come and winch them up. All I can say is I'm wondering if he still has the same girlfriend. That's all I'm wondering.
Wow. Well, I should say that I mentioned that Todd sent us this link, but also in his comment, he's really expressing some skepticism, you know, himself. So, I mean, he's in line with, I think, with others. He says, I'm guessing charges will be filed. So we'll see what happens. It might be interesting to get to the bottom of this one.
Well, and stuff like this, I don't know that they will necessarily be able to get to the bottom of it. Certainly in the first case, that aircraft was on the bottom of the ocean. In this particular case, you know, sometimes engines quit. You know, are they going to be able to, you know, tear that engine down and, you know, find out, you know, if there were problems with it? Who knows? You know, that engine's stuck up in the middle of the woods somewhere. I'm not sure that there's going to be a strong motivation to spend the money to winch it out of the woods to have the engine examined. But I will say that in both cases, they seem to have chosen older, less expensive aircraft, as if, you know, maybe they, you know, were, you know, didn't want to lose a more valuable airplane.
Hmm. All right. Maybe we'll find out. Okay, thanks for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. We want to thank our guest, Pete Zaccanino, CEO of Park City Aviators, PC Aviators, the aircraft management company, racer, and he wears so many aviation hats. I just think that's very cool. And as I mentioned, we'll have links to that and also his books in the show notes. And we'll also have that the video we were just talking about, the crash, in the show notes as well. You'll be able to watch that there. Just go to airplanegeeks.com/685 for this episode's show notes directly. And, of course, you can reach us via email. That's thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. All right, Max Trescott, anything closing out?
Oh, just the usual. Check out the Aviation News Talk podcast. And if you want to send me an email or if you have a listener question that you'd like me to answer on the show, just go out to aviationnewstalk.com, click on contact or on listener questions at the top of the page.
And how about you, Rob?
Well, if people are interested in how much I had to pay Max Trescott to be on his show the other day, just drop me a line, rob@jetwine.com, and I'll be happy to share the financial details with you.
Was it more than we pay you here?
Somewhat. Not much, but somewhat.
Okay.
He gets union scale. That's what he gets.
Yeah, of course. David Vanderhoof, how about you?
Well, you can find me on the Slack listener team and everywhere else you can spell Vanderhoof. And, of course, you can find me at the American Helicopter Museum prepping for March 4th and our brand new exhibit on the helicopter and the presidency.
Great. Looking forward to that. I may stop by and see that.
I hope you do.
Although I can't tell you the number of times I've driven past your house and your in the museum in the last couple of months. But
well, no comment.
We'll stop sometime soon. And I'm Max Flight. You can find me at 30,000feet.com, all words. And you can also check out my aviation podcast directory at, guess what, aviationpodcastdirectory.com. So please join us next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Keep the blue side up.
See you later.
And thanks for listening.